Now we've taken those few steps into the main sort of floral display area. I'm looking at a hall full of chrysanthemums and a whole stack of other things, gladioli, pelargoniums and so on. But creme de la creme, the British National Carnation Society is where we are now, speaking to
Gary Hamilton.
Gary, carnations, I always feel that these days of mobile phones, we've lost something insofar as when you arrange a rendezvous or a connection, you can't say, I'll be wearing a pink carnation by the station.
Why not?
Well, exactly. I think we should. We should go back to those whole setup, etc. What is it about the carnation that makes it a magical flower?
Well, the thing about the carnation is it's just so versatile. You know, it's the traditional flower of the wedding. They're freely available in florist shops. We've got a wide range of colours. Many of them are scented. Some of the English-grown varieties, which are raised by our own hybridisers here in the UK, they've got lovely scent, and we just want more people to grow them.
Makes perfect sense. Leslie?
Well, apart from their obvious beauty, and you've got some superb specimens here, what is it about carnations that does it for you?
Well, I like all flowers, I'll be quite honest. I've grown chrysanthemums and sweet peas, but the thing about the carnation is it's just so versatile. You know, it doesn't need heat. I think a lot of people think that carnations need to be grown in a greenhouse environment all the year round, and that's simply not the case. You've got the border carnation and the pink, which are completely hardy. They flower very, very well in the garden. They're beautiful scent, lovely flowers, and even the perpetuals. Yes, when they're flowering, they do like a greenhouse environment. It keeps the rain off and just gives them a bit of protection, but they are just so wonderful to grow. They cost very little. The heating, no heat required in the propagation stage in July, August, so we just want more people to grow and enjoy them.
So from what you've said, let's take Leslie and Francesca as an example here. I mean, they have a suburban environment, they've got a reasonable sort of area to sort of work within, etc. I mean, if we sort of set a little challenge, would you talk them through how they would set about growing some carnations?
Well, the thing about the pinks and the border carnations is that they're quite happy in the garden border, but they're equally happy growing in pots and tubs. So anybody who's got a balcony, pinks and even border carnations will do extremely well. They like a fertile compost on the alkaline side. So any good multi-purpose compost or Johnny straight from the bag with perhaps either some perlite or a little bit of grit added as extra, and they'll grow away fine.
Oh, so that, can you actually grow them in sort of like window boxes? Not window boxes, but, you know, the garden boxes?
Absolutely. In fact, the pinks do particularly well in garden boxes and on balconies. And if you get the ones with some scent, not only do you get a profusion of colour throughout the summer, that you also get the scent which wafts freely around as well. And the other thing about the pinks, and certainly the pinks, are that they will start flowering round about early June, and they'll go right through to October, November.
Well, these are all, like, stunning. So what would you look for in, like, a winner for a show like this?
Well, what you're looking for in sort of the perpetual carnations, you're looking for good, vibrant colour, you're looking for good form, a nice round bloom, and ideally you want the guard petals to be at 90 degrees to the stem. It's got to be fresh. Above all, it's quality. That's what you're looking for, freshness, form and quality. And size really doesn't come into it.
I've said that all the time, Gary, but that's a different line entirely. A name check for your colleagues who are actually working with you and doing fine work today, of course.
Well, I'm Gary Hamilton. I'm the editor of the British Carnation Society. And I'm joined this morning by Mrs. Faye Seagrave, who is a member of the BNCS and one of our past presidents from last year.
Very important person, then.
Faye comes every year and gives us a hand. And we're also joined by John and Carol Lusby from Lincolnshire.
Fantastic. Well, Lincoln, obviously, Zarin FM, one of the key for areas from that point of view. Gary, it's been wonderful connecting with you, good self. If people are looking to join the British National Carnation Society, what's the web address?
The web address is www.britishnationalcarnationsociety.co.uk, all in lowercase.
Fantastic. See, straight to the former. And what do you think about that challenge of possibly sort of seeing if we can get these two guys growing some carnations through the course of the year? Do you think we should follow that through?
Yeah, absolutely. Everybody should grow carnations. Every garden looks better for having some pinks and borders in the garden. And what better than having some perpetuals, these beautiful flowers growing in the greenhouse or your conservatory?
Sure, we'll be in touch. What say you, Leslie?
Absolutely, definitely. I've got a garden that really needs some
colour.
Colours there.
Now, we're still actually with Gary, and we're just sort of moving around here. In fact, we're also going to be following the former president, Gary, as we wander along. Gary, you were just saying that Faye's husband, late husband, sadly, but absolutely phenomenal carnation grower.
Oh, it was the best. Not only was he a true gentleman, but he was a very, very good gardener. He could grow anything. but his particular love were carnations, the perpetuals, and he had a greenhouse full of them, and he bred some wonderful varieties. In fact, three or four of the best ones that we've got here today, Grange Classics Choice. Grange was his prefix for it, for his own raised flowers, and it is raised Grange Classic Choice, Grange Highlights Choice, forgive me, Grange Highlights Choice, which is a pink ground fancy. Classic Choice is heavily scented, but Bill was a wonderful man.
Let's move over. If you come join us, Gary. He's obviously in full sort of explanatory mode here, having presented Fran with a fabulous carnation. I think we need a few words with Faye, so if we can possibly just interject in a few moments. It's a deep conversation, obviously.
Yes, she is. Faye? We're just talking about Bill. I was just mentioning about the fact that he raised some lovely varieties and Grange Classic Choice, and of course that's the one, highly scented.
Perfume. Oh, sorry.
It's all right. No, so you're coming together. We couldn't sort of leave you out on this particular thing here. Yeah. You must be very proud to see that the things are still sort of remembered from that point of view.
Oh, of course. Yes, I'm highly delighted that people are still prepared to grow the flowers that he brought forward. The two plants that he brought.
Well, I say, hopefully, I say with Leslie and Fran, with the Furmans for Southside Broadcasting, we might be able to sort of keep the thing going even into the broadcasting world.
Oh, lovely. Thank you.
Excellent stuff, Gary. And Faye, of course, many thanks indeed. A genuine privilege. And I just say, I can't believe we missed out on carnations in previous years.
You're very, very welcome.
That's always nice. Wonderful. Just testing that the actual routines are coming through there. OK, we are currently standing by the North of England Horticultural Society's Gardening Advice Bureau. And we're delighted to be able to speak to Graham Porter, the NEHS Gardening Advisor. Graham, I think it's fair to say you've got an absolutely fantastic show here. But presumably your role is to also sort of say to possible wannabe gardeners or people who just have a thought about, let's move beyond the spider plant or something, you know, how can they develop the whole thing?
Yes, it's the role of a garden advisor in these circumstances is that we have to be a jack of all trades and master of not very much. And when you look around you, the masters are the people that have produced these incredible displays, the cacti, the gladioli, the geraniums, etc., etc. And our job is to try and iron out some of the little gardening hiccups that people have in their gardens. We had a gentleman this morning with a rather strange blackberry that wasn't producing the wonderful blackberries he wanted. And in the end, it was discovered that it was actually a seedling blackberry and not a cultivated variety.
Schoolboy error, really. Schoolboy error.
I think that's the sort of thing, you know. So yesterday we had over 140 inquiries covering almost every angle of gardening you can imagine. And it's part of the fascination of the job. So
we talk about the autumn and spring flower shows bringing really to Harrogate not just a flavour but very much the Chelsea flower show of the north in terms of the line. I mean, it really has, it's kind of gone beyond national recognition. It's kind of an international show, really.
I think the Harrogate flower show, because of its diversity and the fact that it's a twice a year show and it's been established for many, many years, I think it's actually one of the best shows in the country. Yeah. That's a personal view, but I think it's the diversity that the show has, not just its quality, but it's the fact that you get all these national organisations like the British Gladioli Society, the Chrysanth Societies, the Rose Societies, and in the spring you get the Daffodil Societies. All these national societies are willing to bring from all over the country, literally every corner of the country they come from, to bring their quality and their plants for everybody to enjoy. So,
well, as you may have gathered, holding in a very tender and almost wonderful emotive way her carnation from earlier today, young Francesca Furman, who's hopefully going to be taking up some of the challenge with her mum of actually growing some carnations to work through that. So, Fran, any questions for yourself?
Have you got a favourite area of gardening to advise people on?
That's an interesting question for you, Graham.
That's an interesting, challenging question, especially with the helicopter just going.
Absolutely, it's good. Yeah, precisely. You know, clearly they've heard about that question. They alert. They put out the alert immediately. You know, yeah, it's a difficult question.
The helicopter just
exactly.
Annoy you. Yes, that's right. I think currently, I mean, I've been gardening personally. I mean, although I'm a professional horticulturist, I've been in my own personal life. I've been gardening in association with wildlife for over 30 years. And I think that my own personal area is to try and steer people's minds away from some of the rather sort of absurd old traditions of gardening practice into a gardening style and technique of management that is more akin to supporting wildlife, and that to me is so critical. And when you speak to the bee people, you know, we've got an absolutely incredible display from the local Beekeepers Association. When you talk to those of the problems that they've had in recent years, part of it is possibly down to some of the absurdities that our gardening practice has been going on.
You can have too many water features, let's be honest.
Well, a water feature should be a hole in the ground with water in it for wildlife, not one of these bubbling monsters, you know.
Precisely. Leslie.
I was wondering, with all of the many questions that you get asked, have you ever been stumped?
That's a very good question. The answer to that is yes. And our attitude to questions we can't answer is leave us your details and we'll find out and we'll ring you back.
Tell me about some of the times then that you've had to do that.
Goodness me, there's a challenging question. It's very often related to pests and diseases where you actually can't identify the pest because you've never seen it before. But there are occasions when you think that the average gardening encyclopedia, decent gardening encyclopedia, might contain 20, 30, 40,000 plants. It's impossible for any professional to know all of them. And so that's where the challenges very often come from. But we always find out for people and we always let them know.
Fantastic. Can I ask you a very basic question? This is driving me nuts. In my garden, I've just cut down this huge bush that was growing uncontrollably.
And it was a triffid, Leslie, I told you, it was a triffid.
It definitely was, Alex, yes. But now, of course, I'm left with this soil area, but it's just getting covered in nettles. But I'm trying to, obviously, encourage the grass to grow. Don't want to put weed killer down there in case it kills the grass. What do I do to get rid of these pests?
Is it a shrub that you've cut down?
It was just a bush that had been there that had grown uncontrollably for about, well, since I moved into the property some years ago.
Do you know what the shrub was?
I'm going to be honest, I don't, I'm sorry.
Because obviously knowing what the plant is tells you then whether the treatment you've given it is either going to kill the plant or is going to help the plant to survive. So
I'm just trying to actually sort of possibly solve this. If Leslie actually took a photograph with one of those wonderful digital camera things and emailed it to you, would that actually help in this problem, in this challenge?
Very often, yes. I mean, I work occasionally on Radio Leeds, on BBC Radio Leeds.
I recognise the quality of broadcaster straight away, Graham.
And you get... We get pictures sent through email, and it's usually, the quality of picture is usually fairly good, and therefore you're able to help identify the plant for them, you know. So
the challenge, Leslie, is if you can actually get a photograph to us, we'll hopefully take Graham's contact details in terms of that, then we'll set up a phone link and you can actually provide advice to part two of this mysterious weed come mysterious bush, which I still think is just an alien sort of life form that landed from Mars.
No, the bush is actually gone now. I cut the bush.
You say it's gone. You say
it was dead. It's the nettles and the weeds that are a problem, that I'm trying to kill those off to allow some grass to grow through.
Right, the nettles are actually a very easy weed to get rid of because they have an extremely shallow root system. And so a decent garden fork shoved horizontally through the soil at about 2 inches deep will quickly flick out a collection of nettles in 5 minutes.
Right.
No weed killers required.
Even better, I'll be doing that when I go back. That's fantastic, thank you.
Make nettle soup and all sorts of things, I'm sure. Graham, it's been splendid touching base with your good self. A reminder, people want to get in touch with the North of England Horticultural Society or join it or support it, presumably the web address is?
The web address is www.flowershow.org.uk.
Fantastic, and obviously all geared up for the autumn package as well. It's been lovely talking with your good self. Hopefully we'll feature you again in the very near future.
Thank you very much indeed.
And so we have reached the honey area of the fabulous world of beekeeping and a staggeringly wonderful array of aspects of national beekeeping with National Beekeeping Association of the Gambia and more. We're delighted to be able to renew acquaintance once again with one of the key folk behind this whole area. And your name once again, sir?
Mike Rowbottom.
Mike, good to connect with your good self. I mean, I have to say, it's the legend, Mike Rowbottom, in so many ways when it comes to Harrogate and Ripon beekeepers. We've just been speaking to colleagues at the North of England Horticultural Society's Gardening Advice Bureau, and they specifically said, always think about the wildlife, talk to the bee makers, talk to the people who are actually dealing with bees when it comes to honey and so on. They'll emphasise how important it is to perhaps think more about the kind of state of your garden rather than things like water features and all the rest of the bits and pieces.
Oh, I'd agree with that, yes. I mean, bees and flowers sort of co-evolved and invented each other, really. So well worthwhile thinking carefully about what you're going to plant in your garden for flowers, because it can make a huge difference to the number of insects and pollinating plants that you get.
And in terms of that, so they're just coming around to actually catch up with us in a few moments, but we've been talking to the Carnation Society today. Are they, I mean, is there a particular kind of floral aspect that bees would be looking for in order to obviously collect the pollen to go back to actually make the honey and so on?
Well, in terms of symbol basics, you really need to stick to the sort of the so-called single plants as opposed to the double ones, because the singles are certainly going to have a lot more pollen and the bees will work those more readily. But it's really a matter of being careful about the species you're picking. There are some plants like Cotoneaster or Skimmia or any of the soft fruits where you will get pollinating insects in profusion. Certainly in our garden, once we got some bees in there, I think the yield of our soft fruit, the raspberries and blackberries, probably doubled over what we had done previously. So the pollinating insects can make a huge difference to your yields.
Absolutely. And we spoke about this a couple of years ago, of course, the possibility of vanishing bees and where were the bees going. Was that a kind of urban myth? Was it something people were concerned about? Have things been addressed? I mean, how is it sort of, what's the shape of bees today?
Well, it's a complicated situation. Certainly, what was interesting, during this last winter, the British beekeepers keep a track of the winter losses of bees, and the losses they reported for the this last winter were actually lower than any of the three previous winters, and were only just above the long-term average value of about 10%. So I thought that was very good news. To get some coverage in the media, of course, they had to write it up as a bad news story, but if you actually look at the numbers, it was actually pretty good news. So in winter losses, that's been quite good, despite the weather being very, very hard over the winter.
In terms of actually looking after bees and being a, quite literally being a beekeeper, etc., what's the kind of outlay that people are actually looking for? I mean, if somebody was actually at the show today and they were thinking, actually, that really does appeal to me, what advice would you provide?
Well, I think there's several advice. Either get in with a beekeeper or better still join a beekeeping association. They will certainly help you a lot. Our association, Harrogate and Ripon, run some really good courses, well worthwhile coming on those. We have longer courses or weekend courses, or if you're just uncertain about how you might react to bees, come on a one-day course. We'll actually put you safely close to some bees and you can just see how you react, which is what you need to know. If you're talking about financial outlay, I think to get yourself fully established, you probably need two hives, to be realistic, and some protective clothing and some other bits and pieces. Probably somewhere round about £400 you would think of as a budget. You might be able to do better. In the past, you've been able to get second-hand equipment, but there's such a boom in beekeeping at the moment that I haven't actually seen any second-hand equipment for sale for a couple of years.
Something which I was going to sort of point out that is becoming popular. If we just move down slightly, Mike, we'll sort of bring in both Leslie and Francesca at this stage, who are currently looking at some of the vast range of stuff that they're actually sort of involved with. I mean, just talk us through, Mike, some of the things that we've actually got here, because you've literally got here under the beekeeper's banner virtually everything from beeswax on to, obviously, the ubiquitous honey.
Well, that's right. I mean, looking at the stand, there's several things you can see. Part of it is actually a honey show in which the classes for all bee produce, you've got all the different varieties of honey plus beeswax plus cakes. But here on the other side of the stand where we are standing now, we're looking at the for sale counter. So what we've got again is honey, we've got jam and jellies made with honey, we've got the comb honey, and we've got a very wide range of products made out of beeswax, from Christmas ornaments through to candles.
Is it fair to say, Mike, that if we're talking about beekeepers' associations, the Harrogate and Ripon Beekeepers' Association is very much in the Premier League when it comes to bees and things to do with beekeeping?
Well, modesty will prevent me from being too much.
I think that's a yes.
I'll take that as a yes, yeah. What we're very pleased of is we've grown the society enormously. I think back in 1998 we had somewhere around about 115 members. Now we've got over 400. And I was looking at an article for a beekeeping magazine just last night, funnily enough, showing that in terms of growth over the last 14 or 15 years, we're up there in the top four or five nationally.
So really the sort of Manchester United, Manchester City really of the sort of area there. Well, not necessarily the Arab ownership.
No, just domestic ownership too. And we're a registered charity as well, but it has been very successful.
So for people who are listening to this and they've sort of been fascinated by the sort of range of things that we've actually been putting into place for that point of view, the web address for the Harrogate and Ripon Beekeepers Association is?
www.hrbka.org.uk.
and testing. And obviously autumn is when the beekeepers come out in force, but I believe you'll be here as well. I'm sure I've seen you for the Spring Flower Show and various other things as well.
Yes, we're here for the Spring Flower Show, and we're also here for the we have a stand at the Great Yorkshire Show in July.
Proving very popular, I must admit. I did pass you by in July, and it was phenomenal. I mean, there were sort of people, it was like six or seven deep at one stage, I thought.
That's right. Well, it's certainly very popular, and also we have we do beekeeping demonstrations every Saturday afternoon during the summer at the RHS Gardens at Harlow Carr and also down at Harewood. And next year we're hoping to do Sunday afternoon demonstrations of beekeeping at Fountains Abbey. We've put a toe in the water there this year and last year. But we're hoping to make a big push there, and they're very supportive of bees and beekeeping.
Certainly something I think we'll look to do as a sort of a day in the life, if we can, and certainly a location report. We're bringing in Leslie briefly. Leslie, you've obviously been purchasing product at nobody's business there, which is great stuff. Mike here, the number uno when it comes to this particular wonderful Harrogate and Ripon Beekeepers Association. Any thoughts from yourself?
Well, yes, we've just been sampling the honey down there, and it's absolutely beautiful, and we've been buying the crabapple jelly with honey in it. How many different types of tastes are there? Well, it's perhaps not how many, but I noticed that honey gives so many different types of taste. Can you tell me why?
Well, it's just all tied up with the trace elements you get from the nectar the bees are collecting from the different flowers. There are a few things in the UK. Heather is a very distinctive crop, and sometimes you get from the lime trees. But there are not very many distinctive individual flavours you can guarantee to get hold of. So one of the delights or banes, if you like, of a beekeeper's life, if you just produce honey, somebody will buy a jar and they'll come back and say, oh, that was fantastic. And I have to give them a health warning and say, well, this one will be different. I hope this isn't good. Because
it's not factory produced, is it? Let's face it. I mean, you've got a lot of it.
Absolutely not. No, it's just produced by whatever the bees collect. And one of the great frustrations, a lot of the time, you've just no idea what it is the bees are collecting honey from.
You'd think they'd do some sort of computer system that could sort that thing out, really, wouldn't you?
Well, you can sort it out, but it just takes time and effort. What you have to do is to extract the pollen from the honey using a centrifuge, and then you can make it some microscope slides. And then the really difficult bit is trying to identify what the pollens come from. They're all distinctive shapes and sizes, but you need quite a lot of skill and expertise to decide what a particular pollen actually comes from.
Fran? Birds and the bees.
You were looking at the honey earlier on because you don't normally
I don't normally like honey, but the honey off the honeycomb over there is really lovely. So.
Thumbs up, you see, Mike. Next generation coming through. I'm sure when we do this report, whether it's at the one of your wonderful horticultural gardens or possibly at Fountains Abbey, it'll be marvellous stuff. Mike, wonderful as ever, touching base with your good self. We'll see you again very soon.
Okay, I look forward to that. Thanks very much indeed.